Good evening. Welcome to Congressman Mike Capuano's telephone community meeting. My name is Allison, and I thank you for joining us tonight. If you have a question for Congressman Capuano at any point during tonight's discussion, just press star 3 to begin that process. We will post an audio file of tonight's discussion on our website when it's available if you're not able to join us for the entire meeting. To access that file or to sign up for Congressman Capuano's electronic newsletter, please visit capuano.house.gov. If you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press star 3. And with that, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Congressman Capuano, who would like to make a few opening remarks. Congressman?
Thanks, Allison. I just want to welcome everybody to the call this evening. I hope you'll stick with us for a few minutes, at least to listen to some of the questions. I'm going to make some brief introductory remarks just to give people an opportunity to dial in any questions they might want to talk about. Just as a catch-up as to what we're doing in Washington, which is not as much as we'd like to do, but we have made some progress. We have passed a highways bill a few weeks ago, which was not a great bill, but at least it maintains the status quo, which in today's world in Washington, that's a pretty good thing. We passed a bill to tighten up our laws relative to visa waivers, and we're still working on appropriations, which is the most important issue. And tax extenders, which we have several tax situations that expire at the end of the year, and we're trying hard to try to find a way to extend them without, but people like me would like to find a way to pay for them as well. Whenever you give one person a tax cut for anything, whether it's a good issue or a bad issue, it costs the government money, which means either we have to increase the deficit, cut someplace else, or raise revenues to cover that. You know, that's obviously balance. At the moment, we don't seem to be prepared to do anything relative to Syria, but the issue has not gone away, and I don't think it'll go away in the not-too-distant, in the near future. My personal hope is that Congress actually takes action to decide whether we support or do not support taking action in that region of the world, taking military action, or further military action, I guess I should say. And the last item I just want to discuss briefly is an introductory item, is obviously gun control. So many of us have paid a lot of attention the last several weeks, unfortunately, to the issue. Most of my constituents seem to want to support reasonable gun controls. I do, like we have in Massachusetts. But I will tell you that at the moment, the NRA has Congress completely under its thumb, and the likelihood of us getting any gun control legislation at all, even getting guns out of the hands of people who are on the terrorist watch list, even that doesn't seem to be able to get to the floor for a vote, and we're struggling to do that, and we will continue to struggle to do that. And finally, I just like to say, everybody, first of all, I apologize going into it right away. I'm just getting over a little bit of a cold. I still have a little frog in my throat, and occasionally I may try to move the phone and cough a little bit, and I apologize for that, but we've all been there, and so it's my turn this week. And to simply then, with a reminder for anybody who wants to ask a question, please feel free. There's no question that we won't answer. If you just hit star 3 on your phone, that'll get you into the queue, and we'll try to get you in line to see if we can answer some of those questions. With that, I'm going to stop and ask Allison if we have somebody on the line, and if so, we'll get started.
And we do. Our first question is Richard from Somerville, who has a senior housing-related question. Richard, when you're ready, your question?
Yes. Mike?
Hey, Rich. How you doing?
Yeah, good. Listen, one of my concerns is I live in Poughkeepsie Manor on Warren Ave. You're probably familiar with that.
And
we have a problem with, in recent years, in the last couple particularly, with younger people coming in, younger and disabled, so-called. Yep. And too many young people are coming in with drug issues. And, you know, they're still at an age, some of them are in their 40s, and they're still doing things that, you know, you shouldn't be doing, at least that seniors don't do. Usually they outgrow that type of activity. And it's not a good mix for our building, and it's being talked about in all the housing buildings around town.
Yep.
Because we're all putting up with the same thing. And, you know, we don't want to deprive anybody of a home or a place to live. But my question is, I guess, is why mix the seniors with these people? Can't they have a building for those type of people? They seem to need a little bit more assistance than the average person and with their drug problems. And actually, there's been danger here as well. You know, one of them acted up and cracked somebody's skull here in my building. And then there was another issue with a broken hand. And, it's becoming uncomfortable for the older people. That you know, they don't want know how to explain it or complain about it. But you know, we had our meeting tonight here in this building, and we told the people that, and of course they said they're under the thumb of the federal government because they have to take in it's 20% now. When it was a state building, it was 13%. So I don't know if you can bring the issue up with higher powers. That I think it would be a good idea if we could put people like that in another building. So I'll say that that's the end of my question. Would you like to respond?
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Rich. You may know that my mother spent the last 15 years up in Brady Towers on Medford Street, and I had a very similar situation. First of all, let me be real clear. The people who are there under those circumstances are not supposed to be engaged in active drug use. If they are, they are breaking the law, and they are subject to every legal recourse anyone has, and that includes the housing authority taking action against them. So anything that's related to active drug use is still illegal and can and should be enforced, in my opinion. Other than that, part of the problem is that we've had so many people with disabilities, and it didn't start out as drug and alcohol disabilities. It started out as people with more physical disabilities, wheelchairs and the like. And the idea, the concept by those who proposed it at the time, and I wasn't in Congress when that happened, I was still mayor, was to say, look, we're not going to put any more money into the housing, so we're not going to build housing, but we will use the current housing for people with wheelchairs. And it started with wheelchairs, and then the definition of disability slowly got broadened until it included people with drug and alcohol problems as well, which to my way of thinking is perfectly fine as long as they're in recovery. It is not okay if they are not in recovery, not for any other reason, and I don't think anybody deserves to be punished by having, especially our seniors, have their last 20, 30, 40, 30 years, whatever it might be on this earth, be disrupted by someone who is actively engaged in breaking law on a regular basis. So I will tell you, Richard, that my suggestion to you is to get the housing authority involved, you're not going to win it to say, let's not let them in. But you can and should win it if anybody is still engaged in active abuse of drugs or alcohol. That is not allowed.
If you're just joining us tonight and you would like to ask Congressman Capuano a question, please press *3 at any point to begin that process. Our next caller is from Randolph with a question about providing safety for Muslims.
Hello.
Mr. Ahmed, whenever you're ready.
I'm ready.
Your question for
Congressman, good evening to you.
How are you?
I would like to ask you, what do you propose or suggest Muslims in the area, in the Boston area I'm talking especially, and surrounding of Boston, how to protect themselves with kind of other kind of people who want to harm Muslim?
Very simple suggestion. I mean, there are always going to be a handful of people in any society that want to act out inappropriately against certain groups. In this particular case, lately, there will be a handful of people who want to target Muslims for inappropriate activity and put them in danger. Anyone who does that is breaking the law, number one. Number two, I think violating our social codes, at least in Massachusetts, if not the entire country of America. We don't tolerate religious discrimination. Every group, I'm an Italian heritage, I'm an Irish heritage, I am a Roman Catholic upbringing. Every one of those groups has had people amongst them that I'm not proud of. And yet the entire group of Catholics was not judged as terrible people because we had some priests who did some wrong things. All Italians weren't. I mean, again, there were always some who want to do that. But the vast majority of people don't want to do that and don't tolerate it. So I will simply say to you, obviously you're going to have to stay alert, bring anything of question to the attentions of the local authorities, and also for the other people on this line, and I know that 99% of us feel this way, if we have a neighbor or a friend who feels threatened for any reason like that, that kind of discrimination is unacceptable. I think most of us will band around them to protect them to the best of our ability and to call out those people who want to make them feel less safe as not worthy of our best times. Again, we have problems today. Some of those problems relate to some people who, in my opinion, have misinterpreted the religion. But that's all well and good. But again, every group that I'm a part of has had some people in the past that don't make us proud. And I don't think that justifies anyone in labeling the whole group as somehow suspect. And I, for one, will stand with any of my neighbors of any religion, any race, any ethnicity, anything, to make sure that you are judged on your own individual merits, not for your religious or ethnic background or anything else. That's not acceptable. And I feel very comfortable saying that the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of people in Massachusetts feel the same.
If you're just joining us and you would like to ask the congressman a question, please press *3 to begin that process. Our next caller is from Cambridge. Mr. Gilmer, you'd like to talk about gun control?
Yes. I was wondering what your position is on gun control, Mr. Capuano.
In general, I favor thoughtful gun control. I am not a gun enthusiast, so I don't know exactly where the line is. I do defend the concept of the Second Amendment. I think it's most people do have a right to own and bear arms if that's what they want to do. However, there are some people in our society that shouldn't have that right for the protection of the general society. And I think the government has not just a right, but more importantly, a responsibility to do everything that we can do to ensure that people who have forfeited that right because of activity, that they don't get guns. The classic one we're going through right now is whether people on the terrorist watch list should be allowed to get guns. I think that's a no-brainer, personally. There have been people who say, the terror watch list is not accurate. Well, I actually agree with that. I've been saying that for many, many years. The answer is then not to say, well, anybody on the list can get a gun. The answer is let's get to work with fixing the list. I don't want anybody on that list who doesn't deserve to be on it. But if there's 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 people in this country who are suspect or who are known to be associated with terrorists, they shouldn't have guns. I can't imagine anybody could argue against that. And yet we can't seem to get that done. I personally don't think there's any need to have automatic weapons. Anyone who wants to hunt, that's perfectly fine. But my way of thinking, if you need an automatic weapon to hunt, maybe you should take up a different sport. All that being said, I don't know exactly where the line is because I am not a gun enthusiast, but I do feel very strongly that reasonable, thoughtful gun control is something that is a very valid thing for society to do. Massachusetts is a classic example. Many people in Massachusetts own guns, yet we have some of the strongest gun control legislation in the country and the lowest gun violence rate in the country. And I think that's proof, more proof than anything I can say. So in general, I support the concept. There may be a line too far, though, but right now we can't even get to reasonable discussions. So that's my goal, is to try to get us to at least have thoughtful discussions with the hope of being able to get something done.
Next caller is from Somerville. Leanne, you have a question about Sullivan Square and the casino?
Hi, good evening, Congressman. I hope you're feeling better soon.
I feel good, just choking like everybody else.
Yeah, I know. I had it last week.
Yeah,
there you go. Yep. So I'm very concerned with the development over by Sullivan Square, Rutherford Avenue, the circle over by the Schraft Building, Washington Street. There's an excessive amount of construction and right now and in general traffic. It's really becoming a quality of life issue for many people in the area. They're proposing the casino, as you know. It looks like it's going forward. I'm very, very concerned with any community benefits that might come our way. What is your view on the casino? What advantages do you see? And certainly I see some disadvantages. I'm not for the casino here so close to Somerville, but was wondering what your thoughts are.
Honestly, Leanne, what I've focused on is not what I want or don't want. It's what I can control and can't control. And good, bad, or indifferent, the chances of the casino coming there are very high now. Boston, I'm sure if you follow this, has just lost or got it dismissed their most recent court case. The likelihood of stopping it is virtually non-existent at this time. So that being the case, okay, if that's what we're going to have, we need to take this opportunity to make sure that the state and the entire region takes a look at that area. That is a regional transportation hub, the entire Sullivan Square area, Rutherford Ave, Route 99, Broadway, Medford Street. That's a regional transportation hub that many commuters use every single day to get back and forth to work. never mind the local people who use it for other reasons. So for me, if we're going to get this, whether we – actually, the truth is, even if we don't get it, this region has problems. It's had problems for a long time, but those problems are made even worse, about 15 years ago when they just overnight took down the overpasses that took some traffic, a lot of traffic, out of the circle. They put all that traffic back in the circle, and every day anybody who travels that can see every single day traffic is backed right up back under 93, backed right up Broadway, backed up 99, backed up Rutherford Ave. It's a horrendous intersection with or without the casino. My argument is, okay, if we're going to get the casino, let's use that as the catalyst to make sure that the redesign of the entire area gets done right and gets done right for the next 50 years. So it's not so much about a casino to me. It's about the opportunity to get some serious transportation problems fixed for the good of a lot of people in the entire – all of north of Boston. So that's what I'm looking forward to, and that's really what I'm focused on.
Vincent from Everett is joining us now with a question about ISIS. Vincent, when you're ready. Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
I am 93 years old, World War II veteran, and I'm a little concerned about something I saw on television. I saw a photograph from an airplane of the ISIS headquarters. And one of the comments was, we cannot bomb it. I want to know if you can find out why, as long as we know where ISIS headquarters is, why we cannot bomb it. That bothers me greatly. Can you find an answer?
I'll have to check it, because honestly, I don't know where you saw that, but it doesn't sound right to me. First of all, I personally think that we should come to Congress get an authorization to do not each individual bombing run, but to be engaged at all. But be that as it may, the United States is bombing every day. They're bombing Raqqa pretty much every day. If they know where the headquarters is, I have no doubt they would bomb it in a blink. The problem is that right now we do not have an authorization to go to war. If you're a World War II vet, that didn't take very long to get one of those. And once we're in, and I actually think that if we're engaged in war, we really need to do it the way we did it in World War II, which is if we're going to go in, we need to go all in. And if we're not going to go all in, then we shouldn't go in at all. And right now, that's ever since World War II, that's our approach has been less than going all in. And I think the results have been pretty obvious. It doesn't work that way. I don't think there's any half war that you can do anywhere in the world. And for me, if we're going to be engaged in a war, not just here, but anywhere, the United States has to be fully committed, and we have not done that since 1945, and I don't think that's a useful activity. But be that as it may, if they're bombing Raqqa on a regular basis, no longer, it's not just us, it's also the French and the British and others, and if they know where the ISIS headquarters is, I have no doubt that they would bomb it, but I will certainly look into it, because if it was reported that way, either the report is wrong or I am misinformed, and either way, I will be checking that tomorrow.
Our next question is from Somerville, Hannah and Micah, who have a question about the job that you're doing in Congress. Whenever you're ready.
What is your job?
My job is a member of Congress, Hannah. It's the legislative body for the federal government in Washington.
And our next question is coming from Milton, Cheryl, who has a question about the recent FAA meeting in Milton. Cheryl, when you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Cheryl, how are you?
Good. I just want to thank you again for last week and hope that you're going to be able to work closely with Steve on being able to get this problem solved. It's pretty interesting that since last week's meeting, we've been getting even more noise, and they've been flying more constantly. I was woken up at 4 a.m. the other day. 4 a.m. is the earliest I've heard this, so just wanted to let you know that. But I do have another question for you about MBTA accessibility for handicapped or those that have trouble getting around. I've recently been diagnosed with severe hip arthritis, and now that I'm having trouble getting around, I'm really noticing the lack of accessibility at some of the busiest stations. The first one that comes to mind is State Street right downtown, when you enter for the Orange Line and you go down to try to go to Forest Hills. There's no elevator access going down, and there's an extremely – there's two flights of stairs you have to walk down, and then a very long hallway to the platform. To me, that is very hindering, and I could just imagine somebody who is really handicapped has no access to that station. I don't understand how with the American Disabilities Act, how the MBTA can get away with that if they're grandfathered or what their problem is.
Well, I'm not familiar with the State Street station specifically. I was under the impression it had been rehabilitated a few years ago, and if it was, it would have had to have been rehabilitated in line with the ADA. If it has not been rehabbed, the ADA does not require anybody to take positive action. No one has to change anything that existed before the law. But what they do have to do is if they do any major work there, they will have to bring it up to current standards, which would certainly include an elevator, if nothing else. I will check with the State Street station. I don't know that one specifically. The T has done many other stations along the line, and right now they're doing Government Center. I have no doubt whatsoever that it will meet standards, and if it doesn't, they have to redo it. But I presume it will because they've done so many others. State Street may be one they haven't gotten to yet. I just don't know, Cheryl, but we'll be happy to check it tomorrow.
If you're just joining us and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Our next caller is from Boston, Fran, with a question about opiate abuse. Fran, when you're ready.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, Fran.
Listen, I email you all the time, so it's nice to talk to you. I can touch on everything you're talking about. I'm one of those that sits in that traffic going to work every morning. And also the gentleman about the apartments. I work in elderly housing, and there's so many that are 62 and over. You know, I hate to say, but you could always, like, I would apply for a 62 and older building. That's what I would do if I needed to get into elderly housing, because I wouldn't, a lot of the disability buildings, a lot of them do opiates or drugs, and, you know, they are bringing down the buildings, you know.
I totally agree. That's why I'm so adamant on active users.
Right.
When I was mayor, we used to enforce that pretty strictly.
Right. But my question was tonight, my daughter passed away 2 months ago, Jillian, and she went to Matinon. She graduated Suffolk University. She had it all. She has three little children. Me and my husband raised them. She had a drunken drive, and the courts took it over, and they just, like, threw the book at her. And, like, they put her in these programs where she just kept meeting worse, like, people, like, doing things like that she'd never done before. I mean, it just spiraled. And we lost her, you know, for 3 years. She lived that road. And she's had overdoses before it happened. And it was like, I don't know, like, something has to be done. I mean, it just seems like, you know, I know so many parents, you know, and they have lost the children, or they've lost a nephew, or they've lost, you know, it just seems like it's so common now. You know, is it going to be addressed somehow, or is there anything that can be done to maybe, you know?
I can only tell you, Fran, obviously you read about the issue every day, and I know there are a lot of people in Massachusetts and around the country, but especially in Massachusetts and in Boston, looking at it, trying to come up with ideas. Honestly, I don't have any wonderful answers that other people don't already try. I mean, having better programs and more programs to deal with people. But I feel confident that if there is an answer, and I'm not sure there is, I don't know, Fran, but if there is an answer, Massachusetts will find it, because you have so many good people that are doing so much work on this issue to try to find an answer. My hope is that what they end up coming up with is not one program, but maybe 10 programs, because no one program is a definitive worker for everybody. Different people react to different programs differently. So one program might work well for me, another program might work well for you. So my hope is that's where they end up. I can only tell you, Fran, that I feel at least good that good people of good intention are trying. I hope they can succeed, but I wish I had an answer for you, Fran. I don't. I don't know exactly what to do, but I think the people in the medical field and the people that do this have the political support right now to actually move the ball forward. So I'm hoping we may not be able to solve it. I don't pretend that we will solve all the problems. But if we can help a handful of people become the people that they wanted to be, I think that's progress. And I feel comfortable we'll be able to do that in the next year or so.
Our next caller is from Randolph. Rona, you have a question for the congressman about community discussions?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, actually, for calling my house this evening. This is my first time receiving one of these impromptu calls, so I was really surprised and pleasantly surprised and appreciative that you called my house. I'm actually interested in knowing how often are you going to have these types of QA discussions with your constituents, and have you had the opportunity to attend any public forums in Randolph?
The answer is yes. I come to public meetings when I get a chance, but let's be honest, I spend 4 days a week minimum down in D.C., so I'm not around as often, and I have a large constituency. So even if I show up, I can only show up in any one place a few times a year. That's the best I can do, which is why I do these phone calls. It's the best way to get a broader reach more quickly. At the same time, I don't do them as often as I used to, and I don't do them as often as I used to because they cost money. Budgets are tight with everybody nowadays. I do try to do them on a pretty regular basis, and I will tell you that, first of all, I appreciate the thought because I like doing them. It's a great opportunity for me to hear a broad spectrum of my constituents. And we're going to try. We did one last night. We'll do one tonight. We probably won't do any more until after the new year begins. And we'll try to do them more regularly, Rona, because I actually like doing them, but they are expensive, and you can only do so much with so many dollars.
Our next caller is from Cambridge with a question about the MBTA. Jeff, your question for the congressman?
Congressman, I don't need to tell you the MBTA is a complete mess. And I really kind of blame the state legislature for really not doing what it takes to sort of maintain the system. As our congressman who can help bring federal money to the MBTA, especially like with the Green Line Extension Project, do you have any leverage to get the state legislature to commit to put the resources into the MBTA to get it working and functional?
My short answer is no, other than the bully pulpit. Obviously, my district is an urban district with Boston and near-end communities. The MBTA is an important part of the daily life that we all live. So for me, the MBTA is a very critical part of transportation, more important, in fact, than highways. All that being said, I mean, you're 100% right. The federal government almost never tells states what to do. We have certain parameters, but we usually give chunks of money. So in this case, we give, I don't know how much, several hundred million dollars a year to the MBTA. We do have certain criteria, but even then the criteria are flexible. But most of our criteria have to do with environmental justice, have to do with maintenance of effort, so that they can make sure that they don't spend the money just doing the expansion and forgetting the existing projects. But to a certain extent, that's kind of what we have to do. I really don't think you want Washington telling individual states or cities how to run their transportation system. That would become a mess. So the best I can do is advocate, which I do regularly. I had one of my local district director spent most of the afternoon at a MBTA executive board meeting, listening to some discussions on the Green Line extension. So it's critically important, Jeff. I'm glad my constituents pay attention to it. I actually think the state is finally awake. I think Governor Baker has committed to getting this right, but we'll see. We'll judge the commuter rail over the winter. I think we're all going to be paying attention to that, and that'll include the MBTA as well. So we want to give him a little time to make sure he does it, but I think you're right to focus on the legislature. They can pressure it, and I will tell you that I know the representatives from Cambridge do that, but there's nothing wrong. It's actually a good thing for our constituents to keep our feet to the fire because we have so many issues that we deal with on a regular basis. Sometimes even the most important issue can be lost in our attempt. I mean, even tonight, you've heard these phone calls. We're talking about guns. We're talking about transportation, airplanes, opiates, housing. It's part of the job of any constituent who cares about any issue is to try to keep it in the front of our face. And I think that's the best thing that we can do for the MBTA is to make sure that our state and legislators and our governor knows that it's critically important to us. And I thank you for the call.
Our next caller is from Milton. Cynthia, you have a question about the recent Blue Hill deer hunt for the congressman?
Yes. Good evening, Congressman.
How are you?
I was disappointed that the Blue Hills Hunt was still allowed since it was based on a survey done 2 years ago. This was done before last winter's record-breaking snowfall that killed many deer. Only 60 deer were killed with 396 hunters hunting for 4 days. To me, this proves that the survey was over-exaggerated and outdated. Many of us would like an unbiased survey done before another hunt is sanctioned next year, and I was wanting to know what your opinion was.
I actually had not yet heard those numbers. They are pretty stunning, to be perfectly honest, based on what I had read and been told prior to the hunt. I think you raise a very good point. And again, I understand that hunting on occasion is an appropriate use of maintenance. At the same time, I don't know the numbers, but certainly if you had 400 people out there with guns and they could only find 60 deer, certainly indicates that the overpopulation problem wasn't that bad. But what I will do is over the next couple of months, I'll try to see where the state's going to go with this. I think you raise a good point. And that I don't think I'll take a position really on whether they should or they shouldn't in a general sense of the word. But certainly they should not do it unless it is absolutely necessary. And these numbers certainly indicate that maybe it wasn't. But I appreciate the call and I appreciate the comments because you've given me a little homework now.
If you're just joining us and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Marjorie from Milton is joining us now with a question about refugees. Marjorie, your question for the congressman?
I wondered how you felt about the two-year delay before we let in refugees, and do you think we should let them in? After all, this country was made up of refugees from this and that over the years. So I was very interested in how you felt about the refugees, because we read about them all the time, crossing the Mediterranean and being drowned, and it's really a terrible mess.
I appreciate the question, Marjorie. The answer is yes. We had a vote maybe 2 weeks ago on this issue, my vote was in favor of taking in our fair share of refugees, not just from Syria, but from around the world, and we do. The two-year delay is nothing special for this. That is the normal course of events. That's what the people on the other side of the issue kept saying, oh, you can't let refugees. The average refugee from any place in the world takes about 18 months to 24 months because we do vet individual people. Not just anybody is legally allowed into this country, and I think that's the way it should be. Now, again, could the 18 months be shortened? Sure, it could be, but that would require an investment in personnel for the State Department, because each one of these people have to be vetted to the best of our ability, and that's what takes so much time. We only have so many people that work for the State Department, so many people that work for DHS that do this work, and if we want to shorten it, we have to invest in hiring more people. That's unlikely to happen, particularly with this particular Congress. But the truth is that it does take about a little bit less than 2 years on average for the average refugee from any place in the world to get here. And by the way, I would note that up until this point, none of our problems have been caused by refugees. They're usually too busy trying to get their lives back together. I would ask anyone to imagine how they would feel if they and their children and their parents were ripped out of their home and told, get out right now with nothing but the clothes on your back and whatever you can carry, and that's it. That's all you've got. It's a devastating situation, and I think that it's the best part of America to allow people here to reconfigure their life and to get back on their own feet. Yes, we have a security issue. We do take care of that security issue, and I, as one American, I can tell you that I feel safe with what it does. That doesn't mean it's perfect. Nothing is perfect. There will always be mistakes made. But the answer to that is not to then shut down the system. The answer to that is to simply be vigilant and to step on the gas to do a better job. So, Marjorie, I appreciate your comments. I agree with you wholeheartedly that America was built on this kind of a system, and I think it works reasonably well, and I'm supportive of America not changing and to continue to be who and what we are.
Our next caller is from Cambridge. Claudia has a question about airplane noise. Claudia, when you're ready.
Thank you. Good evening, Congressman. Thank you
Thank
very
you.
Much for holding these phone side chats. I live in North Cambridge, and for the past 2 years, the airplane noise has been horrific. Last month, I called in 12 times to complain about the airplane noise, runway 33LL, I believe it was, and it's just getting worse. It used to be a very quiet area in North Cambridge, and now it's just horrific, both Somerville and Cambridge, where the planes turn around over my residence. What are you going to do about this? It's just getting worse.
First of all, Claudia, let me tell you that I live on the top of Winter Hill, so the planes go right over my home. And I'm a couple of miles from the end of the runway, so they're relatively low. I will tell you, the entire region is working on this. We actually have fewer planes overhead than we used to, and we have more planes that are theoretically supposed to be quieter than they used to be 20 years ago, and most of them are. But what's happened is that the time of day has changed, the size of the plane has changed, and the pathways that they follow, the flight paths, have changed a little bit. We had I don't know if you heard an earlier call, but we had a meeting down in Milton the other day, a regional meeting. There were several people from Somerville there to talk to the FAA about trying to find ways to not. We can't stop the planes. That's not going to happen. What we can do, I think, is to spread the pain. For those of us who've chosen to live in an urban area like me, like you, we put up a little bit extra noise than people in the country do because that's our choice. It would be nice to have no cars and no trucks on my street, but that's not going to happen, nor is it right. But it doesn't mean that every truck has to come down my street. And the same thing with planes. Excuse me. So what I'm trying to do is to get these planes to move a little bit whenever they're using any one runway, because we get 33, Milton gets the 4s and the 22s, East Boston and Winthrop get other ones. So, I mean, it's the whole area. Logan Airport is right in the middle of Boston, so it's obviously every flight path goes over somebody. And the idea is, again, not to just simply move it off the top of my house, but to say, I'll take my fair share, but let's make sure that everybody who gets the benefit of Logan also gets some of the detriment. And that's been my goal for a while, and I think that we will be able to have some degree of success in the not-too-distant future, but we're going to keep trying until we do.
Our next caller is from Cambridge with a question about the Freedom Caucus. Roseanne, your question?
Oh, hi, Congressman. Thank you for holding this forum. I have a question about Congress, and it has to do with the fact that we read a lot and hear a lot about the Freedom Caucus, which is a relatively small group of Republicans. And my question is, how does this small group, who are really a small part of the majority of the Republicans, control so much? And why is it that the rest of the Republicans and the Democrats combined don't seem to be able to wrest control of such important pieces of the congressional agenda? So I was wondering, what is your opinion and what do you think can be done?
Roseanne, we ask ourselves the same question every day. The Freedom Caucus is give or take 40 members of Congress, which is one-tenth of Congress. It's approximately one-fifth of the Republican caucus. The problem in Congress, it's a good thing and a bad thing, depending on how you look at it. In Congress, nobody can put an amendment or a bill or on the floor without the approval of the majority party, period. Most people don't understand that because they go to a town meeting and they get, if they want to make an amendment, they just make an amendment. Not in Congress. It doesn't work that way. And so, therefore, the majority party has to agree to that, which means they have to make a decision. Do they want to govern with the majority of Congress, or do they want to govern with the majority of their own party? The problem has been that up until now, the Republican leadership has made a determination that they're not interested in working with Democrats on most issues. There are a handful of exceptions, but on most issues, they will only put a bill on the floor if it will get a majority of the Republican Party. And that's we can't stop them. And because of that, their small minority basically scares the bejesus out of the majority of Republicans because they're afraid of getting a primary challenge. They're afraid of the Koch brothers or whoever, not just them, but all those right-wing outside groups coming in and spending $1 million or $10 million saying they're bad people and running candidates against them. And until they get the courage to understand that there are some things, there are many things, that if, look, I don't want to lose an election, but I'm not going to be frightened into not taking action on everything. Look, everybody makes compromises. I get that. But at some point, you have to stand up for what you believe in. And we're just not there yet with the majority of the more moderate Republicans. And they are the majority. It doesn't mean I'm going to agree with them. It just means I have a chance of at least coming up with a compromise. The Freedom Caucus has them on the run. And I will tell you that I don't know when it's going to end. It won't end at least until the next election. But if you can ask me this question, I'm going to ask you the rhetorical question. Please explain to me the popularity of Donald Trump. I don't understand it. I mean, I do understand it to some small degree, but not really. And I think it's very much the same thing. You know, people just get up and they state their own facts, and that's it, and you're not moving me. And if you're not willing to kind of run over them and say, okay, you can have your opinion, but we have the majority, and here we go. And until that happens, I'm afraid the Freedom Caucus is still going to have us tied up, which is why we have so many important issues that are still outstanding.
Our next caller is from Randolph with a question about the Affordable Care Act. Manny, your question for the congressman?
Yes, thank you. Mike, I appreciate this. Coincides with something that happened today. In 2016, there's a provision, I'm assuming based on Obamacare, that people who are in a domestic relationship outside of marriage but are providing the health care for their domestic partner are now being taxed on the company's portion of what they contributed, which for me results in a approximately $2,400 penalty tax. I wonder if you're aware of this
and if you
think this is fair. Yes,
it's a new one to me, Manny. I'll have to check this one tomorrow.
Okay,
is this something from the employer? Give me a little bit more information.
Okay, here's the way it worked. I cover my girlfriend and my son on a family plan. What's happening in last year, there was no tax ramifications. This year.
Is this an employer provided plan?
Employee provided plan, yes. And it's Blue Cross Blue Shield. And now what they're going to do is the portion that the company pays for my girlfriend, which comes out, I believe, to about $8,400, is now going to be taxed. So now I get whacked with approximately 25%, which comes out to about $2,000 to $2,400, because I am providing insurance for somebody. It seems like an awful penalty. If we were married, there would be no tax.
I'm going to have to check. This is a new one to me, but I didn't even know that you could cover somebody who wasn't married. That had a lot to do with the argument that we had on gay rights, so that they could get married, so they could have family coverage. This is a new twist to me, Manny. I'm going to have to check it. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer for you.
Yes, a lot of companies do offer domestic partners, whether it's same-sex
or
opposite.
I think it's a good idea.
I
don't
think
any problem.
So, too. And I'm thinking, you know, we're going along with the game. We're helping. We're covering our people, and then we get penalized all of a sudden.
Do me a favor. And could you call my office tomorrow? Because, honestly, this is something I don't know the answer. And I don't want to let it drop. I mean, we're going to chase it a little bit. It may take us a few days to find the answer because I don't know. But it is something that I don't know what I can do, but I certainly want to know what the issue is. So I'd appreciate if you could call us tomorrow, maybe with some more details.
You want to give me that number?
Sure, 617-621-6208.
Okay, I do have the right one. Okay.
Okay.
All right, and again,
thanks,
I appreciate you doing this.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
We have time for just a few more questions this evening, and we do apologize if we don't get to your calls, but you will have an opportunity at the end of this telephone community meeting to leave a voicemail for Congressman Capuano. Our next caller is from Cambridge with a question about Social Security and Medicare. Joyce, your question for the congressman?
Great. Thank you. And I just want to say, Congressman, I'm so happy that you are our congressman.
Thank you, Joyce.
It's very rare that I agree with people in Congress. I almost never disagree with you.
Don't worry. If this phone call goes much longer, I'm sure we'll find something.
But I'm 68. I'm on Social Security and Medicare. And like a lot of people, I don't have enough money in retirement to retire. I still have to work, which is fine. I don't have, as long as I'm healthy, that's not a problem. But I'm concerned with future cuts to Social Security, Medicare. Why is it that the rest of the world has cost controls on pharmaceuticals and our pharmaceutical costs are out of sight. And I think that most people don't realize the difference between what we pay here and what somebody in Canada would pay. I mean, the difference is phenomenal.
I'll tell you directly, Joyce. The reason, in my opinion, is very simple. The rest of the world will be, you know, Canada, England, France, any country that has universal health care, which is most of the countries that are similar to us, Western Europe, Canada. What they do is they're one entity. They're Medicare. They're example of Medicare, which covers more people. They negotiate directly with the drug companies for a specific price. And they say, and they get to a point, they do negotiate, but if the company is not willing to meet that price, they say to the company, then you cannot do business in our country. Simple. So the company goes below that price, but they come to America, in the health care bill, we specifically, and actually in the drug bill, the Part D that we passed, eight, 9 years ago, we specifically said the United States government is prohibited from directly negotiating with drug companies on behalf of Medicare and Medicaid, which made it, and I'm not blaming the drug companies, I'm blaming us. We're the ones who are at fault, because if we use that big pool of clients to say, hey, we need to negotiate, well, I actually don't even think we need to negotiate. I think all we have to do is to say, okay, we're not negotiating, but we're taking the average price you charge Canada, England, France, Italy, Germany, and whatever country you want to throw in, and whatever that average price is, we want the same price. And if not, then you're not going to sell in the United States. And here's what they would have to do. They would then have to raise prices in those other countries while they lowered our price so that they could still continue to sell in the United States of America and not lose money. I understand these are private companies. They're out to make a buck, and I don't blame them. That's America. God bless them. But right now, they're making their money on the backs of Americans because we did it to ourselves. And I personally think that it's outrageous. And again, I don't blame the drug companies. Who doesn't want to make a buck? I blame us for letting that happen. And no other country that is similar to us allows that to happen. So at least on that issue, that is the first and foremost thing that we need to do, is to say, here's five countries, and whatever you sell to them, we want the same price. Kind of simple. And honestly, I think what would happen is our prices would go down, other countries' prices would go up. We would no longer be subsidizing Canada and England and France. And the companies would probably then have to make a decision how much money they want to make, and like every other business. But they have a captive audience here in America, and they've used it to a fairly well, like anybody would do. So I have a hard time blaming anyone for being a little bit on the greedy side. We're all a little greedy. But I blame the people that have allowed us to be put in that position. We did it to ourselves. We can get ourselves out of it, and I think it's the first thing we should do.
Our next question comes from Dorchester. Roy would like to ask about unemployment benefits. Roy, your question for the congressman?
Hi, Congressman.
Hey, Roy.
Thanks again for having these meetings. And I've been in several, and I'm just very appreciative of them that you always include me. My question is in regard to unemployment benefits. I'm a professional. I've been working for years doing what I do, and I make a pretty good income. I pay into the tax pool. However, unfortunately, I got laid off. And when I needed those benefits, they were there, but they were cut. I think that, it's only 6 months now. So, what I'm doing is basically, pulling out of my retirement fund, which is the second part of my question I'm about to ask. So the question I have to ask is, I hear that there's no money, which is why that cut was made. But then, I also hear on the news that we find money, to sustain and go to war. I'm like, why can't we, sell a fighter jet and take care of our own people? Why do we always, seem to take care of external issues before we take care of internal issues? I hear that we have to repair Iraq, justifiably so, since we made a mess there. However, isn't there one here? And, there's plenty of places that, are in shambles. And then the other thing is, if I have to dip into my retirement fund to simply survive, is there a penalty still attached to that? I understand that penalty makes sense if you are not in dire straits, because your retirement fund is there to be there for you for when you retire. However, when you're in a critical situation and you need to simply survive, there shouldn't be a penalty on survival. And I'm wondering if there's anything that's going to change on those two issues, and that's my question. Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate it, Roy. The answer is probably not. We had this fight a few years ago to extend unemployment insurance to people who are on long-term unemployment. We lost, simply put. The only way that's going to change is if we get a new Congress, to be perfectly honest. The members of Congress right now, the majority feels that unemployment is not something that the federal government should be deeply concerned with, so that they limit it. It was always limited. It always has been limited. The question is, what should the appropriate length be? Excuse me. And I would say that the appropriate length depends on the economic situation. Now, we are doing better than we were once doing, but I don't think anybody can look in the mirror and honestly say that the country's doing great yet. I mean, I'm not complaining. It's better to be headed up the ladder than it was a few years ago down the ladder. But we're not back to where we once were, and I don't know when we will be, but we're not there yet. So I would argue that. As far as taking the retirement out, I'd have to know the individual situation right now. If you want, we'd be happy to check it. If you should just call my office tomorrow sometime, and we'll chase that down. But I think there are some exceptions, but I'd have to know the more detail about the retirement plan, and what the situation is to be able to answer the question appropriately.
Looks like we have time for just one more question this evening, and if we don't get to your question, we do apologize. You will have an opportunity to leave Congressman Capuano a voicemail at the end of this discussion. And our next caller is from Randolph with a question about the Second Amendment. Peter, your question for the Congressman?
Yes, thank you very much. I believe Congressman Capuano, and I'm sure you're a Democrat. The question that I have has to do with Second Amendment, which I believe most Americans, I believe in Constitution, really. But this Second Amendment is a real problem if we use it as an excuse most of the time. And I just want to have a scenario whereby if someone is sick, you know, we look at the symptom, and at the same time, we go to the source as a doctor to make sure that symptom does not exist anymore for somebody to survive or to repair their bodies. So why is it that guns is such a big deal, which in the first place, as I understand, it's the Second Amendment is meant for a militia and not for individual. And at this point, it looks like every American's talking about Second Amendment, their right. And then these guns are ended up in people who just don't care. Gun kills, period. My understanding, from my point of view. So my question is, what can the Congress do, even if you're a Democrat, to convince people to understand that the Second Amendment is the problem we're having in this country? It's not the gun. It's the Second Amendment. I mean, if you want to get rid of guns, you have to take away the Second Amendment, more or less, or something about it.
I don't think the Second Amendment is going to go anywhere for the foreseeable future. However, the Second Amendment does not prohibit the federal or state governments from levying reasonable limitations to the right to carry arms. And the interpretation of exactly whether it applies to the militia or the individual, that's always at the Supreme Court, and they're always making that argument. But regardless of that issue, the right of the state and federal government to impose reasonable regulations, such as a background check, such as a 3-day waiting period, such as you can't sell armor-piercing bullets, such as you don't have to have an automatic weapon. There's dozens of these issues that we could implement across the board, but honestly, it's not going to change with the current Congress. The current Congress is elected by people who don't agree with us. And until that changes, the federal government won't take any action, so therefore we have to look to the state governments to do it. And we're fortunate enough to live in Massachusetts, which has the most stringent gun rules in the country, and the lowest violence rate, the lowest gun violence rate in the country, which I think is proof positive that these reasonable limitations can work. Obviously, Massachusetts is a small state, so it's easy to get out of and go to other states that are a lot more lax on it, and it is difficult to enforce carrying guns across state borders. Some of these regulations should be done at the federal level, but in my estimation is the likelihood of anything passing that right now is almost non-existent. As far as the Second Amendment goes, I don't think we, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but if I can't impose current limitations that the Second Amendment allows, the likelihood of changing the Second Amendment is even lower than changing federal law. So right now I think we have to turn to the states to try to ratchet that up and to continue the vigilance to try to get Congress to change its mind. And I will tell you that I appreciate your position, and I share your position, Peter. So thanks for the call.
That is all we have time for this evening. We do apologize if we were not able to get to your question, but you will have an opportunity to leave Congressman Capuano a voicemail at the end of this meeting. And with that, Congressman Capuano would like to close out our discussion tonight. Congressman?
Thanks, Allison. I want to appreciate anybody who listened to us at all tonight, especially for those of you who stuck through at the end. I will tell you that I always enjoy doing these calls, but as you can see, we have many, many issues to discuss, some of which we can make some progress on, some of which are new to me, which is why one of the reasons I do these calls, and some of which we have a lot more work to do. But I will tell you that for most of us, we're still very lucky to live in America. We're very lucky to live in Massachusetts, and I'm very lucky to have the honor of representing you. So thank you all for participating in this. And again, I apologize for my occasional cough, but the cold's getting better, but it is the season, so that's life. But again, thank you all very much, and good night.